Well, hello there. My name is Adam Eve, and I'm also known as the Record Doctor. And on this episode of Oral Fixation, I head into the virtual studio with your hosts, the lovely Andy and Drew, to talk all about Dead or Alive's incredible new NRG trance romper of an album, 1996's New Cleopatra. Now, there were quite a number of records by many different artists that I could have gone for as well. So I hope that you'll stick around to find out why New Cleopatra was such an important record and why Dead or Alive's late frontman Pete Burns was exactly the queer icon I needed at 13 years old. It'll all explain why I chose this record for Oral Fixation. And speaking of, it is an absolute honour and a privilege to be invited onto one of my very favourite podcasts, and I hope that you all enjoy this just as much as I did. Now, on with the show.
Okay. So, Adam.
Yes.
We've known each other for a very long time. I think we first crossed paths on the Pop Justice forums all the way back 2008, 2009, if not earlier.
Right, right.
And for the benefit of Drew and also our listeners, I've been spending the last few days just musing over how best to paint a picture of who you are, of moments from our friendship. And the best I could come up with was listing some of, in my view, Adam's best bits. Oh, your very own immaculate collection, if you will. So,
please indulge me. You've just been kicked out of the Big Brother house, Adam, and this is your two-minute VT.
Oh, I'm living for it. I'm finally having my moment.
Want another one?
Oh.
Want another one?
Okay. Oh, God, I'm absolutely vibrating. Go on, Andy.
Okay. So, Adam Eve is a DJ, radio show producer, and all-around pophead on a scale rarely found who lives in and around Melbourne, Australia. He's produced his own magnificent music devotional, The Record Doctor, for years. Last year, he launched a new monthly podcast with his friend Eliza. This is Disco, All Minogue, All the Time. More on that later. Adam is one of the very few people I know who I am happy to say is an even bigger fan of Madonna than I. It's just factual. I don't fight it. Adam is, in fact, the biggest fan of several acts that I know. He once quit his job to fly from Australia to the UK for the first time to attend several dates of the Girls Aloud 10 tour, interspersed with One Direction and Drag Race gigs, traveling by planes, trains, automobiles all across the country. He's met Lady Gaga several times throughout her career from beginning to current. His number one of all time, correct me if I'm wrong, is the Balkan Madonna, an icon called, I'm going to pronounce this terribly,
Lepa Brena,
who I've learned an awful lot more about through Adam's social media. Adam and I have been to countless gigs together, including the Rebel Heart Tour Down Under, mm-hmm. Khalees, Elton John in a winery near Geelong.
Oh my gosh.
But perhaps most pertinent to this discussion, Danny Minogue's comeback gig at the much-missed Greyhound Hotel in St. Kilda, which was recently discussed on his superb two-hour interview with the icon herself on This Is Disco. Adam, we could talk to you for hours. There is so much to discuss, but in classic Oral Fixation fashion, there is one artist and one album, in fact, to steer and tether this chat to. Months and months ago, when I first approached you and said, look, we've been dancing around this radio, you've got to come on. You didn't take too long to come back to me with the artist and the album specifically. Right. So, after that introduction, could you please tell Drew and I and our listeners why you picked the artist and the album for this episode?
Right. Well, first of all, what an introduction. Oh my God, that was way to blow some smoke up my ass. Loved that. But look, I'm sure that like many of the old school Dead or Alive fans would probably have chosen another earlier record from them. But this is the one that lines up for me the most, especially the importance to my queer story, I guess. Because, well, so I guess I'll take it to, like, the very introduction of when Dead or Alive first sort of came into my world.
Please, please do.
And I guess that sort of came from the 7-inch single collection of my wonderful mum, Azra. I was born into You've Met Andy. I was born into a pretty young and music fanatical family. And between mum and my auntie and my uncle, I kind of took their love of music and just multiplied it by like 1,000, you know. But with You Spin Me's original release, I was obviously just a bit too young to understand what was going on outside of there being a pirate on the TV with an amazing song. Like, that was literally my outlook on that video clip when I saw it. No connection to him looking like a woman or anything like that. So fast forwarding the story to like 96, I was in the thick of being obsessed with this long gone Melbourne based youth radio station called Hits FM. May she rest in peace. I even volunteered there for a little bit, and it's where my love of radio really, really began. The Hits were essentially just banging out dance, club and dance pop out in a radio climate that here in Australia at the time was 100% pure classic Aussie rock. Literally, that was all you could hear on the radio. The Novas and the Hit Networks, as we hear them in Australia today, can all thank Hits for changing the landscape of radio in Australia through the 90s.
And that, sorry, this was 96 that they sort of started to get...
Well, Hits was... Hits started in 92.
Right.
But around 96 was it really at the peak of their popularity when, like... it was proper competition for the commercial networks. The commercial networks were shitting themselves because Hits were getting all of the younger demographic and then some, and they were just this little community radio station that could only broadcast 3 months of every year. Yeah, so it really coincided with the dance music boom that took over the Aussie charts through the 90s and from about 1991 as well. But the world of Nucleopatra was first introduced to me on a Hits radio show that was actually hosted by Rogue Traders frontman James Ash, because that is where he got his start through Hits FM. So,
right.
Yeah, and obviously...
And for those not in the know, Rogue Traders were Voodoo Child. That was their big...
Right, huge.
With Nat Bass from
Neighbours. Izzy,
yes.
Yep. So, obviously I knew the original, as I said, of Spin, but this new remix was something else. It was the full Sugar Pumpers 96 remix of You Spin Me Round Like a Record. And it sort of took this already brilliant pop song and just threw every kind of mid-90s dance music trickery into its remix. Just, it's probably a bit sacrilegious for me to say, but I to this day think that the Sugar Pumpers 96 meets eats the original Dead or Alive, pardon the pun. Yeah. So this was also the very first time that I would see what Pete looked like in 1996, and it was a bit of a formative moment in my queer awakening.
And what does he... Because forgive me for not knowing the full timeline, Adam, but in my understanding of the sort of evolution of Pete Burns' aesthetic, mm-hmm. all I've really got is the original You Spin Me Right Round video, which I think is that sort of mid-80s that came out?
83, 84, I think.
Right, okay. Yeah. And as you say, the look was very much sort of pirate, right. Or a young mind would go to pirates.
Right, yeah, definitely.
And now we sort of view that a bit more sort of through perhaps a more queer lens or a more sort of androgynous lens. Mm-hmm. But then my next... touchstone for Pete's aesthetic is Celebrity Big Brother, where full on kind of pumped and dressing a sort of, while very much identifying as a man, dressing as a woman and looking like a sort of a highly surgically enhanced woman at that. So in 1996, what was the kind of the look of Pete that you were picking up?
It was just super, super feminine. And this was, I also think this was when he was at his most beautiful as well. Just when I finally saw the Australian only video for that 96 mix of Spin, I was just floored by how beautiful he was. And I remember this CD maxi single for the mixers in Australia came out on, I think it was the Sony Dance Pool here in Australia. And on the cover, it was Pete in one of his soon-to-be famous fur coats.
Not confiscated by the police, this one.
Giant lips, exhaling smoke with a fag in his hand. Just, you know, just looking gorgeous. Very much the Pete that I fell in love with. Uh-huh. And the internet was not really the beast that we see it as now. And 96, the information I had access to was nothing, basically. And so I was probably using Yahoo on like a Netscape browser. Like, that's literally what the life was.
That's clear.
Encyclopedica Britannica.
Yeah. Encarta 95, dead or alive.
Yes, on my Windows 95 desktop. oh my God. But, yeah, I couldn't find much about him, but I could gather from what I did find on the internet that Pete was really quite vocal about the fact that he was a man, and that was shocking to me. I think more so not because he looked like a woman, but because the song was being praised, purchased, and played all over the country by some of the straightest DJs and club music fans that you'll find. That was shocking, that somebody so obviously flamboyant as hell had, I guess, made it. Especially to my 13-year-old eyes, I had only just come out the year before and was still about 2 years away from finding out that my King of Pop, George Michael, was as camp as a row of tents. So I had no representation. And sure, there was Boy George, but Pete did it all on another level that to me was beyond the realm of George. And although there were quite a few Dead or Alive records in my mum's record collection at the time, my family never actually had any Boy George or Culture Club, so that didn't become a thing for me until much later.
That is interesting.
So Pete was it for me.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that, because there was this sort of ongoing rivalry with Boy George and Pete Burns,
right,
as I understand it.
Right.
This on and off. Apparently Boy George paid for Pete's funeral at the very end.
Yes.
Which is a lovely kind of closure of that kind of on and off friendship. But so many things there, Adam. First of all, shout out to your iconic mum. She makes a mean lasagna. And I think she also introduced me to the concept of Turkish coffee, which I'd never had before having it at your house. But yeah. I've known for years that she was this music fanatic who got you into it. But I think there's something really remarkable about a few years ago, you know, it kind of came across my radar, just getting lost in internet archives, that it was a bit of a joke that every time Dead or Alive would try and, you know, make another attempt at a comeback, or, you know, every few years re-release something, they would remake You Spin Me Round.
Right.
And that was kind of my intro to it, coming in at a more modern lens of who is this 80s novelty band constantly remaking this song?
Yeah.
And now knowing what I know, let alone the research I've been doing since you told me and Drew and I to listen to Nuclear Patra, I just have so much more respect for them as artists.
Right.
And but that makes it even more remarkable to me that they still did like a new version of You Spin Me Round for pretty much every album or something. It's kind of amazing.
Right.
I love the thought specifically of you finding the 90s version as a teenager and thinking, how can someone so flamboyant, so camp, be so successful, when actually that was the effect that the song would have been having a decade earlier as well.
Yeah, and not knowing it at all that was the case.
Exactly. And then cutting forward another 10 years, another 15 years to Pete's massive exposure in the UK and Australia on reality TV, I just think one of the most fantastic things about him as a queer icon is the impact he's had on both gay, straight, wherever people identify on the spectrum, in terms of just making people question themselves.
Right.
Just really making people feel a level of discomfort and sit with it, that you're looking at a surgically enhanced female presenting woman who outright insists that they identify as a man and nothing else.
Yes.
And they've never wanted to be anything other than a man.
Right.
And I think some people might try and put Pete in a bit of a box of using language that we're comfortable now with in 2021, such as non-binary, gender non-conforming. But actually, I think it's a dangerous game to play when there are certain people that we've covered on Oral Fixation and who we talk about as queer fans who we can kind of speculate or read between the lines of how they might identify, how they might identify now if they are, you know, a sort of vintage vanguard artist. Mm-hmm. But Pete Burns has always been crystal clear about how he identified. Yes. And I think it's a fool's game to even, you know, there were times where I'd be thinking, would we call Pete Burns non-binary now? And actually, that doesn't matter. Right. Who cares? Yeah. Pete Burns was a man who wanted to dress however he wanted to dress. And that is just so intrinsically queer and cool. And I think what I was just trying to say was he would I think he's made countless people question what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, what it means to be queer.
Right.
And I'm just really excited to talk to you both more about Pete Burns.
Yes. Oh, you mentioned Big Brother, and I rewatch his season quite often, and I remember when it was airing, I was literally downloading it on dial-up modem, taking, you know, 8 hours to download a 375 meg episode of Big Brother just so that I could see Pete, because I was just so fascinated that he was actually going into the house. And there was stuff on Big Brother that he was talking about in regards to gender expression and what he was doing that is kind of the norm now, what people are talking about all the time. And like you also said, Andy, that he was doing that long before he was on Big Brother as well. So he was doing that when his career started in the punk route of it all. So it's a pretty incredible story. And I've always been sad that it felt like he never really got his justice, even after death. I guess I felt really sad because when he died, I really thought that there would be some kind of radio tribute or like even a bloody Rage special, something, you know. So, and nothing, I couldn't see anything. And it was all about the novelty hit, this plastic surgery gone wrong. That was the story, you know. Mm. So much that in the end, it actually made me get back into radio 5 years. 5 years ago now, after a long time away from it, literally through the death of Pete, the Record Doctor was born.
Really?
Because I wanted to have a vehicle that I could pay tribute to him. And on the third episode, that's exactly what I did. And
right. And what did, and so your, forgive me for not having heard that episode, I don't know if it's sort of available, but What did that episode entail? How did your tribute look?
Well, I just played all my favourites and sort of talked a little bit about what we're talking about tonight, I guess. And I did a re-rub of the episode probably about a year and a half or two ago, because when I listened back to that episode, obviously it was like the third episode of a show and I hadn't been on radio for nearly 10 years, so I was like rusty as hell. And I was like,
we know nothing about that, Adam. Our early episodes are perfect.
Professionals from the, perfect. From the off. Not still learning.
Oh my
all.
God. Yeah, yeah. So I did end up redoing the show and putting a bit more focus on the legacy and all the hard work that Pete and Dead or Alive really did and how important it was for queer kids growing up who really, really loved them and really, really loved Pete.
Well, I think that's... I'm so glad that this is the sort of... We will get onto the music, but I think that it's probably maybe more than in other episodes of Oral Fixation. It's important to kind of have this discussion about Pete as the artist up front, because I would imagine that not a lot of people really know much about Dead or Alive. They didn't have that many albums. I personally had only, before you made this playlist for us,
right,
Adam, I'd only, I think, heard You Spin Me Round. You Spin Me Round. So, and my sort of big, my big moment with Pete had been Celebrity Big Brother, which course, I think yes. was around 2004 or 2005 in the UK.
Yeah, and six, yeah. Something like that.
For, 2006. So, and for me personally, I was 18. I didn't know I was queer. I didn't think I sort of understood what queer meant yet. But here was this creature, beautiful creature on the screen, who all at once was so authentic, so cutting, and sardonic, and a bit of a cunt.
Oh, but not just a bit.
with tongue lodged firmly in Botoxed cheek.
Right.
You're insincere to the point of nausea.
Oh my God.
That is just... But there was love there. There was love with I mean, there was there were certain people in the house that he just could not abide. Joey, and that was, you know, that was how that was. But there, you could tell with some of the younger contestants like Preston from The Ordinary Boys and Chantel, who famously was the non-famous person that had been put into the house to convince everyone that she was famous, which is just one of my favourite reality TV twists, perhaps of all time. But he did have this... He wasn't this cold-hearted, past-it, sort of jaded asshole. He was an asshole, but he was caring and honest and he did sort of, I think, educate me as to what the spectrum of queer can look like. One element of the spectrum of queer can look like. As someone that, as a young person, and up until the relatively recent past, has probably seen quite a lot of stuff in binaries. And Pete would have been one of the first people to really confuse me as an 18-year-old who had come out when he was 15 and thought he knew everything about the world.
Right.
So... I'm really glad that we're having this discussion, and I'm really glad that you did your tribute episode for Pete all those years ago and that you re-upped it recently. But
we'll link to that in the show notes for this episode.
We'll link to that in the show notes, but I'm so glad that we're here now having this discussion because the legacy of Pete should live on and will live on in these discussions.
Yes, and that's why I was so excited that you both wanted to have me on the show to do the album and talk about Pete and Dead or Alive, because it is such... He does hold such a very, very special place in my heart. And I know a lot of others as well, like a lot of my friends, like Ben, Richard and Anthony, massive, massive Dead or Alive fans. So there's a...
Shout out to My Name Is Not Suzanthony.
Yes, big shout out to My Name Is Not Suzanthony.
Deep friend of the pod.
Yes, a legend. he sent Eliza and I, just going quickly off topic, he sent Eliza and I about like 200 Danny Minogue gifts when we started the podcast. He was like, here. And we're like, oh my God, thank you so much. Because there are like 3 Danny gifts when you search her on Twitter and it's all X Factor stuff. So yeah, we got all these amazing gifts from Anthony, from Danny's. I just love mentioning that whenever I can because it's brilliant.
You know what, Adam, on the most recent episode of Oral Fixation that just aired, it would have been a few, if you're listening to this now, it would have been a few episodes ago, we spoke about Joni Mitchell.
Yes.
And our guest Matthew was talking about the fact, we were all talking about the fact that as queer people, we sort of hunt for things and we hunt for, I guess what you were saying before, representation, trying to see yourself in other things in culture. And I feel like people like you and people like My Name Is Not Suzanthony are the holy grail of the... You guys are the Indiana Joneses.
Oh, my God.
That are just hunting. 200 Danny Minogue gifts, you know? Yeah, downloading Celebrity Big Brother over a course of 8 hours. You are the archaeologists. You are the queer archaeologists that we stand on your shoulders.
Shoulders, Adam. And for more My Name Is Suzanthony, please check out, I think, our 3rd or 4th Q&A episode. It's in the archives. But very good friend Anthony is of Adam. And I guess this is a great segue into this bonkers album. Because this album specifically has such a chaotic story from what I've been reading about online. So Adam was crystal clear. It had to be this album, New Cleopatra. I was like, literally never heard of it, but we're going with it because it's going to be great. So it came out in what, 96 or something you mentioned earlier?
It originally came out in 95, but in Australia, it didn't get a release until 96.
So they've already been going for over a decade at this point, but the 90s landscape is very different to the 80s landscape. Mm-hmm. They've stopped working with Stock, Aitken, Waterman a long time ago.
Right, yes.
They're still working out their own sound. I believe this is their final album of completely new material. I think they did another one, but there was a lot of covers on that one.
Yeah, so Fragile.
But this album seems to have flopped completely the world over, apart from Japan, where it was an enormous success. Yes. Is that true?
Yes, correct. I haven't been able to ever find what the official final chart position was. So we don't have 100% confirmation, but I do know that they had a massive promotional tour in Japan either before or after they came to Australia, because they did an Australian promotional tour for Nuclear Patra, I think, towards the middle of or the end of 1996. So Pete was appearing on TV shows here. Well, a couple of TV shows here, but I specifically remember him appearing on the queer TV program back in the day that was on Channel 31. So I remember he did an interview there for that. But originally, 96, when it came into Australia's world through Sony, with a very different cover, and thank God, because the...
Wow, the covers.
Oh, God.
Is there 8 different variants of an album cover?
There is, something like that. Some days I'll, be looking on Discogs or something, and then a version will pop up that I'm like, I've never seen that cover. it's just insane. And all of them, bar two, are terrible. The Australian cover is gorgeous, and I think classic Pete photo as well. But Australia was the only region that had that cover. I think Japan might have had a version with that as well, but in the end, when they did the recent remasters and the vinyl reprint, it's had, the not-so-great covers. So I have the vinyl's right behind me, but I hate the cover. Which is why I have the proper cover printed as a giant poster instead.
as we
Adam,
can see.
Adam, forgive my ignorance. What's Discogs?
Oh, my God. So Discogs is how do I explain it? So it's basically an online catalogue of pretty much every CD that's ever been released.
Right. So the IMDb of...
And vinyl, but vinyl and cassette, any everything. Kind of music format for any kind of album ever.
Yeah, VHS is even on there. It's crazy, crazy good. If it's not on Discogs, it might not have existed.
Right. I feel bad for not being a hog.
Oh, they have a great marketplace as well.
Ooh.
Great marketplace, but it can become very addictive.
Present fodder.
Yeah.
So... The other day, we've confirmed the album for a while now, and we're talking about it, and you emailed Drew and I, and you are, again, very adamant that the album that we know of on streaming services is not up to your standard. So you actually took the liberty of making a playlist for us in Spotify in your preferred tracklist order with, the B-sides and the remixes that are missing. And that is what Drew and I have been listening to. So
oral fixation first.
Right. Well, this is the full Australian official. This is how the Australian CD came out. The playlist that I've sent you.
Right.
Is exactly the order that it was on the Australian CD release.
Gotcha. And it's correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a mix of stuff that had been released on other albums. There's some covers on there of Blondie and David Bowie.
Yeah, so because Unhappy Birthday was originally on the previous album, Fan the Flame. So this is where the Nuclear Patra story gets really confusing. So it was on Fan the Flame and it was then remixed for Nuclear Patra. However, here in Australia, the CD here had the Fan the Flame original in its place. So again, there's another reason why the Australian version was slightly different. And this was not... this is a practice that was quite common here where... The most recent one, I guess, is when Girls Aloud released Chemistry in 2005, and they put The Show and I'll Stand By You on it and took two of the album tracks out in its place.
In Australia?
Yeah, because Chemistry came out in Australia in 2006, and it had, because they decided to go after Chemistry. Chemistry was the first single here in Australia, and then after that, they released The Show as the second single and that did nothing.
That's wild. Because around that time, I know we're going off topic, but around that time, that's when they were trying to break Australia. Because I remember there was an E4 documentary called Girls Aloud Off the Record. Adam!
I have the DVD.
Need to remind Adam of this.
I have the DVD on the shelf over there.
Oh my God, we're not going to have it. I need to come down to Melbourne ASAP.
Adam, and that's where you met them, right? You met them outside a hotel or something when they're on that
show. You weren't on the show. Tell me you weren't on the show.
Thank God. That was the one day that they weren't filming from, like, the hotel. So I was very, very lucky.
It's one of music's big anomalies that, by and large, the UK and Australia share pretty much the same musical landscape in terms of UK artists being known in Australia. Maybe less so vice versa, but in terms of the pop landscape of that time, there really was quite a lot of crossover. But for some reason, Girls Aloud just did not register with the Australian market commercially. And it interests me so much because I have no idea why.
Neither do I. I think a lot of people said to me at the time that it's too British, which I was like, what the hell does that mean? I just don't understand, because Sugar Babes worked here to a point. Like, their last big hit here would have been Push the Button.
Yeah.
About You Now, sorry. That would have been their last big hit here.
Probably the same in the UK then. They didn't really do anything. Yeah. That was their last number one.
Right.
But hang on, we're getting off track here because Adam, you were explaining. So the Australian track list is different to what listeners will find on streaming services.
Mea culpa, okay? Mea culpa.
That's going to be on the Patreon. That's going to be cut up. What is going on with this album?
I really, really don't know. It is really, really confusing. The track list skips from all over the place, from region to region. I think there's the Japanese version, the Australian version, the European versions, which are similar to the Australian version, and the French version, and then a US version in 1998. So it's just...
Isn't there like a South African one as well or something?
Probably.
But for the purposes of this podcast, the Australian version is canon, okay?
Right.
That's canon.
We need canon. We need the canon. And I don't know about you, Drew, but for the last week or so, so it's spring here in Australia now. Shout out. We're sorry that, you know, Northern Hemisphere is going to autumn, but we deserve it. We need the spring.
We need this.
And I've been driving around with the windows down.
I'm imagining you in desolate regional Australia, just with high
pumping
energy.
Pumping out this, like... four to the floor wall of high energy sound, just screaming and cackling my head off. I don't know how this album makes sense, but I am now a dead or alive stan.
Yes.
I'm a card carrying stan. I stand dead or alive. This album, it's a hot mess
in the very best way.
It's chaotic. It's that I found myself, you know, listening to songs thinking, I'm loving this, but I feel like I'm straining to make out the vocals because the synthesizers are so loud and dominating. But I'm actually also not mad. Like, I don't want to change it. It's amazing. It has this wild cumulative effect. And I'm, of course, Rebel Rebel, amazing Bowie cover. I actually didn't click that it was a Blondie cover until I saw their songwriting credits on Wikipedia. I didn't click that as a Blondie song.
Yeah.
But the rest of it is just, what's going on? I mean, what... Drew, what did you think of when you heard this album?
When you made the playlist for us, Adam, for some reason I hadn't gotten around to listening to it yet. I think Andy must have sort of pressed play as soon as the email had come in.
Yeah.
And Andy texted me saying, I'm crying, laughing, imagining you pressing play on this first song and just imagining your face. The first song being Cleopatra.
Right.
Which starts very bombastically of just spelling out New Cleopatra in a way that I wouldn't have guessed that it was spelled if I hadn't seen the actual song written down in front of me. But you know what? Even though it is, this whole album is so chaotic and it's so like, Pete's voice is just so undeniably British and ridiculous and commanding. I found myself getting sucked in.
Mm-hmm.
I did, like, by the end of New Cleopatra, it starts and it's sort of very N-U-K.
Right.
And I was like, right. By the end, when there's a line that I won't be able to quote it directly, but it's something like, I look like a woman, but I'm obviously a man or something like that.
I'm
just like kind of finding myself. I'm doing my exercises in my room and I'm just like, this is a bit of a bop actually.
Right.
And I think that it's so interesting. I think we're allowed to say that this album is chaotic because it is. And the way it was sort of, you know, put together is very, it's not like there's been this concept that's been carried through throughout and it's this sort of well-realized, rounded thing. It is completely chaotic, but in a way that does actually end up making sense to me. Mm-hmm. In the way that actually, I guess, my relationship and many people's relationship with Pete is. When I first kind of perceive it, I'm a bit like, wait, what the fuck is going on? But over time, as I kind of learn a bit more, actually I find myself very much endeared to it and intrigued by it. And I can't stop singing Happy Unbirthday.
Oh my God,
baby,
yeah, yeah.
To myself.
Yeah. Happy birthday, yes, yes.
And happy birthday, baby. you know, it's just, it is so unique and so quintessentially Pete Burns. And I'm so glad that it's been brought into my life. Will I listen to it for decades after this? Maybe not.
Yeah, yeah.
But maybe so.
I can say yes.
Maybe so. Yeah.
This isn't the end of me in Nuclear Patra.
Oh, you, God, well, I you're love the,
you're,
that.
You're a converted stan.
Pardon?
I'm a nukie. I'm a stan. I'm a stan of Nuclear
what
Patra.
Adam, what do Pete Burns / Dead or Alive fans call themselves?
I don't know. I don't think they got to the point of naming themselves. And that's another thing about, because when I've talked about this with a lot of people,
you're going to have to come up with
Veronica. Yeah, probably. I may have spoken about this with you before, Andy, but I think it's very, very lucky that, in a way, that Pete died when he did, because he would
very
not
young,
have
been... Very young, wasn't it? 57.
He was, but he would not have been able to survive what would happen afterwards in the world and the climate. Sure, what he was talking about was so ahead of its time when he was talking about it, but at the core, he also was like a bit of a fucking cunt. And a lot of the stuff that he said, especially some of the stuff that he said on Big Brother, like you would not be able to get away with saying today to anyone. Or so much like Joan Rivers... They would not have been able to survive the climate, the change that the world would take.
Pete cancelled himself before he got cancelled.
Right.
He cancelled and checked out, but also, I guess the other side of that coin is, I'm tempted to agree with you, Adam. I'm very much picking at what you're putting down. And Drew and I do make pains to make it clear we can't talk for people from other experiences. But you know what? Pete could... And Pete could have been a very powerful alternate opinion to certain viewpoints on gender conforming precisely because he has lived his entire life as gender non-conforming. Right. I haven't. So I'm very limited in, you know, the opinions I can broadcast. But I think that Pete's voice may have been an interesting addition to the debate because of the life that he has lived.
That's actually a really good point. Yeah, I was just going to also say in regards to the opening track, Nuclear Patra, what you were saying about the lyrics. Hearing the lyrics to this song lies pretty much everything that you need to know about who Pete was, with this sort of stadium, high-energy, trance pop banger. Some of the lyrics, like you said before, was had the King of Japan sending me telegrams saying you look like a woman, but you're obviously a man. And other lyrics like, you saw a He-Man body with an angel face. I was a different gender. I had thick mascara all around my eyes. Not a man, woman, boy or a girl. I was a brand new species. And it summarized everything that you needed to know about Pete. And I think that's also why it makes like the chaos of what follows it okay. Because this song in itself is as chaotic as the rest of the album is.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the story is
amazing. Can I ask you a question, Adam? Who is or who are Glam?
So Glam, all right. Glam was a dance act because they had a, what was the song called? Hell's, It was Glam. Sorry, let me just look this up quickly.
No, that's fine.
Hell's Party.
Live sleuthing.
Yeah.
Live sleuthing.
It was Hell's Party by Glam. Huge, huge dance track in the 90s. And then they did Sex Drive with Pete in 1994. With that, that song, again, thanks to Hits FM, they released Sex Drive, and I popped the original mix in the playlist that I shared with you both. There was no official video for it, and like not until the birth of YouTube would I see Pete performing it on an Italian TV show back in like 94, 95. But this track was huge here in Australia both times it was released. And I remember my uncle buying the CD single and it being absolutely faceless. Generic 90s dance music single artwork, like with the tiniest font of From Dead or Alive under Pete's name. Like it was just standard dance music single.
Interesting.
Right?
Because I very much know that aesthetic that you're discussing.
Yes. It's
the kind of like Phragma, Toka's Miracle.
Yes.
Just the plus. Sorry, yeah. That. Positiva.
Yes, very positiva. Very that. So it was
Lola's theme.
So, yeah, it was really just, we all knew that it was Pete because we kind of knew who Pete Burns was to a point, and also it said under it, you know, From Dead or Alive, but there was no video, there was no connection, but huge here in Australia. Then it was remixed for Nuclearpatra, re-released, and it did well again the second time as a Dead or Alive track. So that song's got an interesting history as well.
So, highlights of the album. I've got to say, first listen, I thought a bit of a throwaway novelty, but I completely stan, no surprises, the Bowie cover, Rebel Rebel.
Right.
I think it's an absolute raucous scream.
Yeah.
It's a chaotic cackle. I love the way that, you know, Pete just bellows in that camp Pete Burns fashion, like, your face is a mess. Like, he's just outrageous and iconic, and dare I say, do I prefer the cover to the original?
Oh my gosh. I love that. Oh wow. Okay, yeah, I'm here for this. It's so funny because I was reading through Pete's book yesterday, and it had a section on David Bowie, and he was like, now, because he was so obsessed with David Bowie, and in the book he was like, now when I look back at it, I realise it was all Angie Bowie that I was obsessed with. and he was like, what did he do after Angie left? Nothing. Like, it was just like,
another
just so
arguably one of the, along with Pete Burns, one of the top five celebrity Big Brother
yes
contestants moments.
This is full circle. This is completely
is
full circle.
Crazy.
In our David Bowie episode, we basically just talk about the music and then we just slate David Bowie for being like a fake queer. Well,
yeah,
I do.
Yeah,
I'm not going to speak for True. Mm-hmm. And actually, we could go back and record like an addendum and just be like, basically, David Bowie's queerness is Angie Bowie. And see Celebrity Brother for more details on that, basically. Drew, what?
I can see is Tiffany
highlights
now.
Well, I think one of my highlights is I'm a Star.
Yes.
I think there's a line about, correct me if I'm wrong, Adam, but there's a line about Pete, basically, like, it's all about knowing you're a star, right? And, like, maybe I should bribe the DJ. Maybe that's how I'll, like, get my song played. Like, I believe it, I'm a star. And there's something that felt very kind of like, as I listened to the lyrics, I was like, lol. But as a sort of, often when I'm listening to music that has been released, for the podcast release in the past, I imagine my young self listening to it and kind of putting it through that queer lens and wondering
right.
what I might have thought if I'd heard that at the time in
yes.
1996 when I was years old. No, I was about 10. And I would have probably felt really drawn to this person saying, like, I know I'm a star. People aren't really picking up what I'm putting down, but I know it. And it just goes to show that I haven't really learned much over time because I still very much resonated with that song. But another song that I really liked was Sleep With You. And
oh,
I, like,
yes.
Now, Adam, I'm going to, I think, trivia. I've got some trivia or something that I picked up that I want to know if you picked up on it as well. Right. And I might be wrong, but I'm going to go with it. There is a line in Sleep With You that goes, "Once I believed that when love came to me, it would come with rockets, bells, and poetry," which is a sample from Mama Cass's It's Getting Better, which was used famously in, I don't know if you've seen Beautiful Thing, which is a coming-of-age story set in South London from the early 90s, but that is one of the songs that was used in that movie. And listening, as I was listening to that song, I was like, fuck, I recognize that those lyrics, and I was saying them to myself, and I heard Mama Cass's voice, and I was like, oh, maybe it's Make Your Own Kind of Music, and that's kind of like a nice little, I don't know, like, symmetry or whatever. But I googled it, and it wasn't. It was from It's Getting Better, which is an even more obscure song, and I just thought, Pete, you iconic archivist, for referencing this song.
Wow, I did not know that. I think he was a big fan of Mama Cass, and...
Well, it makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, he was a big fan of Madonna as well, till the end. He did a cover of Why Is It So Hard.
Oh, what?
Yeah, yeah, it's
I did not know this.
I've just out-tributed the Record Doctor, and the Record Doctor just out-Madonna'd Andy. It's happening live. It's happening live on air, listeners, and we are loving it.
Well, we knew it would happen. I'm just gagged that when it does actually happen. When Adam out-Madonna's me, I'm just gagged because I never get out-Madonna'd apart from when it's Adam. Stop. Where is this cover? You probably have it on some kind of hard drive somewhere. I will send it to you. Like on an M4A.
No. It was released. It was officially released on the big box set that came out just before Pete's death.
Right.
It was a huge box set of all of their albums reissued and heaps of extra stuff. And his cover of Why Is It So Hard was on there. He also did a song with the Pet Shop Boys.
Wow. Oh, that doesn't surprise me. I'm sure that they would have been kind of mutual fans of each other.
Yeah.
I can just imagine like Neil Tennant just being in awe of Pete Burns' absurdity and also kind of just seeing through it. And this is something else I wanted to mention that, Drew, you mentioned earlier the dreaded word authentic, but that is what Pete Burns is.
Sorry.
The authenticity. What? No. He absolutely is. He's the definition of...
authentic to the point of nausea.
Yes.
But you see through the costumes, and you're aware that they're costumes. They're fabulous. Mm-hmm. We love that they're there, but you know that they are costumes. They're a decision that Pete is consciously making in how he wants his image to come across. But through that, there is this talent. And I think he's also said he actually has no interest in being a musician, no real interest in being, you know, hates the sound of his own voice. But he knows that he has this star quality. And I just think there's just something so cool and badass about this. Yeah, I don't know. I'm jumping all over the place here. Maybe this is a bit more of a closing comment. But then I come back to what you said, Adam, earlier about how he actually just didn't really get his due and his flowers and maybe still hasn't received them yet. And I think about people like George Michael, who's maybe at the other end of the, let's say, aesthetic of 80s, 90s gay pop star, and how, quite rightly, the world had this enormous reappreciation for George Michael when he sadly passed. They were like, wow, we've just lost this massive legend. Yeah. I'm not comparing George Michael's musical output to that of Pete Burns,
but I do
hope that one day, you know, sometime sooner in the future, that there does start to be this reappreciation of not just his impact on queer, gender non-conforming people in the media, but actually also the music.
Right.
Because
yes,
the music kind of slaps in places. Mm-hmm. There's something there that is... there is raw talent there. It's not just a complete shambles.
No, you're right. And I think the last album, Fragile, was just a really big mess, I thought. And it's probably my least favourite out of all of their albums. But there was still something special about some moments on it. So there was every Dead or Alive album is pretty special to me. But this one, I guess, is the most. And it probably is the most because it was the one that really got me into Dead or Alive and started my fascination. And it also aligns, as I said earlier, with me exploring how gay I was or what being gay meant to me, you know? So I think that will always... I know it's not probably technically their best album, but it's my favourite of theirs.
And if we could... I know it's like picking your favourite children, Adam, but if you could pick a couple of your favourite tracks from this album, what would they be?
Yeah. So it would be... obviously, title track, Cleopatra. The Sugar Pumpers mix of You Spin Me 96.
And specifically the Sugar Pumpers.
Specifically the Sugar Pumpers. And International Theme. If not only for the lyric, made front page news across the world when you overdosed in Rome. Just bonkers love song souped up as a high energy 90s banger with a weird drug overdose in the middle. It's just...
It's actually a very Xenomania line, that is. It's very Xenomania to just be some kind of random city drug overdose, whatever.
When I lost you in Japan. It's very when I lost you in Japan.
Very
But okay, I like that.
Andy, you make a really, really good point. And I think that Xenomania, which is the house that built Girls Aloud and have written songs for many of our idols... are in many ways descendants of Stock Aitken Waterman in or the Stock Aitken Waterman family, of which Dead or Alive, correct me if I'm wrong, were one of the first uptakes.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think that there's something really pertinent in the fact that we've talked a lot about Girls Aloud, but it seems to me like definitely artists like Dead or Alive would have informed that specifically, like earlier when we were talking about Girls Aloud, you said, Adam, that the thing was that they, the reason why they didn't resonate in Australia might be because they were too quote unquote British. And we actually have a Girls Aloud episode. I think it was the fifth episode that we did. So again, as we were saying earlier, really, really schmick and well produced. But we spoke a lot about the fact that there is just something a bit weird and a bit off in the lyrics of Girls Aloud's music, and that's what drew us to them. Because there was this weird sort of, you know...
Get your kicks like flies to shit buzzing around the model zoo. Like, bonk, what the fuck? Like, one of my favourite lyrics of all time. What the fuck? Like, it's just, yes, I know exactly what you're saying.
And it's, I think it's nice that we're sitting chatting about Pete Burns from Dead or Alive, and I can see Girls Aloud right... directly behind you. Yeah. And it doesn't surprise me that you quit your job and went to the UK to watch Girls Aloud countless times when someone like Pete Burns was informing your musical tastes from a very young age. And I think there's there's a really nice through line there.
Right. I love that. I love that, especially because I, since Sarah's passing, I pretty much just have been listening to a lot of Girls Aloud and a lot of Girls Aloud, watching a lot of Girls Aloud, and I have to keep taking breaks from it every now and then, but for the most part, I'm just like, I... Tying that all together like that, that's really nice. I love that. Thank you.
You did some very touching tributes to Sarah online, Adam. There was some really beautiful stuff, and I was actually talking to Drew about it after she passed in that. I'm not going to lie and say that Sarah was my absolute favourite, but I couldn't help but feel moved when she did pass that. One, she was just outrageously young, so young. And two, it's that quintessential thing that happens whenever someone in the public figure who was, you know, talented, done something great, when they do pass, you of course appreciate them so much more when they've gone, which is just the cruel nature. It's just human nature, really. But, you know, she was kind of the glue that held that group together. She was the one who, when there was the bickering between Aaron Nadine and Nicola and Cheryl, she was the one who would bring the girls back together time and time again. And sadly, you know, they end up reuniting as friends, kind of on her deathbed. It was all just a bit poignant and really, really sad that there could have been so much more out of that group if they'd just got their shit together and given it a few more years and been big grown-up girls. But anyway, look, a life is not to be lived just to be part of a pop band, but that was just a really sad ending for her, I thought.
It really, really was. Mm-hmm. She deserved a lot better, but especially as the person in the band who arguably loved being in Girls Aloud the most.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But,
Happy, definitely we'll come back to Pete Burns before the end of this, but I'm very conscious, Adam, that there are so many topics that we would love to talk to you about, and we've got a limited time. So yes. I think, Drew, we need to come back to the elephant in the room with the Yella Glen bubbles and the Danny Minogue Young Talent Time cupcakes baked by Eliza Day, right. Because in the last week, both Drew and I have listened to Adam's.
I'm a recently converted Eliza Day stan, by the way.
Oh, I love that. Eliza's the best.
I've got two podcast heroes with the surname Day. I've got Elizabeth Day and I've got Eliza Day. And I know who I'd rather have a bottle of wine with. I'll tell you right now.
A bottle of Kylie Yellow Glen.
Yeah, as long as it's not the red.
Adam, I remember... I want you to tell the story. I remember last year during COVID, you started this new podcast. Why did you start This Is Disco?
So primarily I was like, I wanted more so to kind of hard print Danny's legacy, her musical output. Like there's a lot of really, really good stuff in her back catalog. And I also know that Eliza is, you know, Minogue super fan, just as I am. And I was like, I would like to do something that celebrates both of them and allows us to talk about the work of both of them. And, you know, it might not have to always be about their music. Like, you know, we might do something about the clothes or whatever. You know, it's sort of endless about the possibilities, but we just really wanted something to highlight how amazing their back catalogue was. And I thought it was good that it would be something that it would celebrate both of them.
Mm. But I've got to say, there's not been that many episodes. I think you release a new episode monthly.
Right.
So the world was completely gagged when you announced that you had gone from basically recording this amazing, highly produced, very warm-hearted, fabulous fan podcast in about 6 episodes to sitting down with Danny Minogue for a 2-hour Zoom.
Yeah.
And literally interviewing the person that you've made a podcast about.
Danny's
what the fuck?
I'm still pinching myself over it because it was just, it happened so quickly because we put out the 50th celebration episode where we got to speak to people like Terry Ronald and Ian Masterson and Danny Im, and just so amazing. And as soon as Danny heard it, she got in contact with both Eliza and I, and she was like, she was just really moved by it, and which is what she said in the interview as well. And then her management got in contact with us and they were like, Danny wants to come on the pod. When can we organize it? And within a couple of days, we were sitting with her. It was later at night, like 8:30 or something like that. And we're on the phone with her, well, on Zoom with her for 2 hours, and very, very, it's very surreal because I said to you, Andy, ages ago as well, I was like, I always knew that at some point we were going to have Danny on the show, but I didn't expect it to happen in the first year.
Yeah.
Like that was very, very lucky. And we're very, very blessed that she loved that episode so much. And she said to us, it was like the best birthday present she got. Yeah. So,
and I've got to say, Adam, I listened to, because it's a 2-hour podcast episode, yeah, so you will forgive me for breaking up my listen.
Of course.
But I started yesterday and I finished today. And two overwhelming sensations I got from listening to the episode were, first and foremost, Danny Minogue is such an absolute sweetheart. Mm-hmm. And she was just so generous with her time.
Oh, I know.
She gave you guys everything that you wanted. She gave you those little behind the scenes tidbits. She wanted to know what you guys had experienced only her, but music and the connections that you'd forged. And it was just such a treat to listen to. But the other thing that gave me a shiver when I realized it was that during the Neon Nights period, which is arguably Danny's imperial phase.
I agree.
There were 2 mashups made of her songs.
Mm-hmm.
And the first was Don't Want to Lose This Feeling, mashed up with Into the Groove.
Right.
Madonna, your huge icon.
Yes.
And the second was...
Sorry, who are you talking to there?
I'm looking at both of you on the screen here. And the second was a mashup with You Spin Me Right Round.
Correct.
And again, there's symmetry going on in this episode.
Right.
I Begin to Wonder and You Spin Me Right Round, perhaps one of the best mashups of all time that came out during that sort of, you know, early 2000s mashup peak period. It was just so cool to have that realization and then to say to myself, you're going to chat with this guy in less than 24 hours about Pete Burns, and Danny Minogue had a song mashed up with Pete Burns' most famous song.
Oh, wow.
So basically, Drew and I are you and Eliza, and you're Danny.
Stop it. No. You're Danny. Oh, my God.
You know, you're the doctor. You're the attending. We're just the interns.
You know, stop.
Adam, there was a bit of myth-busting going on, though, because Drew and I have recorded an episode of Oral Fixation on Neon Nights with iconic UK pop star Tom Aspel when he was out in Australia. And on it, we mused over the songs that Danny was offered, you know, In Our Minds, Lola's Theme, Believe. And in that podcast, you asked her outrightly and she confirmed it was a hard no.
Yeah.
So we might have to go back and record another addendum for a Danny episode.
Do you believe her?
I do. It was pretty immediate as well. Like, as soon as I said it, and she looked like she had no idea what I was talking about.
Really? I wonder where that rumor started then, because I've heard it.
Same.
In multiple places.
But this is what fascinates me. This is where the pop star themselves is so far removed from the pop justice message forums. Yes. And there is sometimes this enormous dissonance between the writing and the hours. And I'm not mugging those people off. I was that person for many, many years. And my legacy, who I am today, was born on those message boards. But sometimes it is a bit like, guys, get a fucking life. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's prototype. Pop Justice was prototype Reddit, essentially. It was queer.
Yeah, message boards. Yeah, all those message boards, which I was a huge fan of back then, as we both were. They were, basically the precursor to Reddit. Big time, you're right.
Mm. Well, I was going to say, is there any other business? If often we say, Adam, you know, we're coming to the end of the yoga class that is Oral Fixation, and if there's one more stretch or one more little position that you'd love to flex into, if we're talking specifically about Dead or Alive and Pete Burns, is there anything that we haven't covered that you're dying to cover?
I don't think so. I think we've covered the core songs that really roped me in, and everything else is either like a big favourite or I'm happy it's there, and it sort of just plays into the chaos of the album.
The one song I was going to touch on that I don't think we've discussed is Gone Too Long.
Right.
And earlier we were talking about the Pet Shop Boys, and obviously, well, maybe not obviously to everyone listening, but in cycle 3 of Oral Fixation, I believe, or maybe cycle 4, we discussed Behaviour. By
Behaviour.
Behaviour.
Yes.
yes, actually.
Please.
And, of course, the first song on Behaviour is Being Boring, which is a tribute, I guess, to those lost as part of the HIV and AIDS pandemic. And Gone Too Long seemed in that set, I'm completely projecting and imprinting, I do not know any of this to be fact, but it had that same, as Pete would have, you know, lived that same experience that Neil Tennant lived.
Right,
and in being a similar age at the same time, and it sort of seemed to have that, those flecks of melancholy and longing that Being Boring also has, and it just sort of reminded me a bit of that era, and the fact that there's so many of our amazing queer touchstones that we looked to for representation have been through that unknowable thing
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And must have informed their art in some way.
I think I definitely can get that from Gone Too Long as well. I think that's a really, really good point. And I guess probably, I know he did, that Pete had friends, obviously, that he had lost to the virus, but I definitely think that it probably did play a big part on that song. Because again, I know he covered Why Is It So Hard because he loved Madonna and he loved the message of the song, but it would make sense that, but I'd never really kind of got that. So I really like that you brought that up because I'd never sort of put two and two together about that. And I've listened to the album so many times.
Drew, when you were saying that, you reminded me that that's actually also a really great potential future Pet Shop Boys album title. That. That.
That.
That.
That.
That.
This. Very that, Harvey, this.
Yes, please.
Yes. One of my favourite Pete stories ever was learning that when he was in his very, very early 20s, before he became a recording musician, and he would work for many years in a Liverpool record store, mm-hmm. And would often, if people tried to buy something that he didn't like, that he didn't approve of, he would either refuse to sell it to them, he would throw the disc at them. He would start verbal arguments. And I just think, how did he manage to keep that job for so long when he was actively, you know, losing money for the owner, keeping customers away, but being an icon?
Here's the thing, though. He wasn't really keeping customers away because they were so scared that whatever album he made them buy, they bought. Right, these people would come up, they'd come up to the counter and he'd be like, no, that's crap, you should listen to this instead, and make them buy the album. So he was doing a pretty good job.
A salesman through and through.
In a way.
Adam, there's one thing I didn't mention about you in the biography because it's taken many years for me to overcome my envy. However, when I think about it now, I just think pure euphoria and joy because the circumstances in which it happened were just so perfect in that there is video and photo proof of Madonna touching Adam.
Right, yes.
And...
Where on the doll did she touch you, Adam?
Pardon?
Exactly.
Where on the doll? Show me where on the doll she touched you.
Yeah. it was here, actually. It really was.
tell us about how that happened, Adam.
It was at Tears of a Clown in Melbourne, which... So I had tickets to all the Australian shows, which was six in the end. And then she announced Tears of a Clown.
Have you paid off that credit card yet? Is that paid off?
Yeah, that's paid off. Thank God. Last year.
For those that don't know, which includes me... What year is Tears of a Clown? What era is this?
Right, so that was... Oh, shit, was it 2016? God, you think I would...
Yeah. So it's Rebel Heart, and is it like a side gig that she did?
So what she did was she said she wanted to do a special show in Melbourne for the Australian fans because she'd neglected us for so long.
Oh, actually, and Andy, is this the one... Andy and Adam, is this the one where she performed... Like Nothing Fails and
yes.
or Ecstatic yes. Process yes. and kind of like yes. some of the more kind of B-sides.
It was
but
very
more
American Life.
Kind of. Yeah.
Very, very much. Yes, it was. It was
basically,
such an incredible
she
life.
Called you up and said, "What do you want?" You said, "I want this." She came over. She did it.
Pretty much.
This goes out to all the discogs.
Yes.
This is for the discogs.
Oh my God. Far out. Well, I the whole night was because we were there, it was me, Richard and Hassa in the line, and when we got there, like we got there like that morning, which was like 7:30, 6:30, something stupid like that. And then of course we weren't in the venue until 1 AM the next day. So we were there for a long time because we were supposed to be in there at 8 PM. So we thought it would just be, a cute 12-hour wait. That's fine. So at 1 AM, we're finally inside and we get our spot at the front. She comes out on that bloody tricycle, unicycle, whatever it was, and jumps off it, sends it rolling, and it comes hurling at Richard, who's standing next to me. And Richard's like, oh my God.
Very, very sort of a reverse Living for Love at the Brits. Sort of, yes, she was getting her revenge. She saw that backup dancer in the crowd, and she thought, right, this tricycle's for you, tits.
So she throws it at poor Richard, and it's hurling towards him. He catches it, and she's like, oh my God, sorry. And she like said something to him. And so this is like, she's basically just come out. And we're like, what the fuck, man? Like, she just spoke to you. She said sorry to you because she nearly killed you.
And
right?
He didn't want to hear. He
didn't
say
sorry
know.
To anyone.
Right. So we're like, oh my God. So show goes on. We're all losing our minds. We lost Hussa in the line coming in, but Richard and I somehow managed to stay together. She performed the show, all amazing. Then it was towards the end and she was doing Borderline, and she sort of started to the right of the stage and she was kind of like singing to everyone and touching hands and all that stuff. And then it came up to me and I had my phone filming because I wasn't looking at the phone either. It was just filming because I had like her standing right in front of me. And she held my hand and then sang a little bit of Borderline and then went on her merry way and smiled when I saw the video later, smiled into the camera. And it was just, I just still couldn't believe it. And I got two speeding fines.
Can you send me that
home.
Video, please?
Oh, yeah, definitely I can. I definitely can. But I got two speeding fines driving home. Two.
Because you were just high from it?
Just driving on air, basically.
How many demerits was that, doll? That would have been a few.
Yeah, it was. And I also lost points when I went to a Rogue Trader show at a winery. So me in concerts driving home after like an amazing experience.
Similar ilks.
Yeah, it just doesn't work, unfortunately. But yeah, no, Tears of a Clown was amazing. Very, very surreal. But it was also the very first time that I saw Madonna in concert. And it was not what I was
expecting. Of course, because she had not come here. And you'd already quit your job and blown all your cash on the Girls Aloud stint of 2013.
Right.
Did you go to the... I mean, there were a few O2 dates, but I was at one of the O2 dates as well. So maybe we were in that same arena.
Quite possibly, because I went to two O2 dates.
Right.
Yeah.
You did the O4.
Yeah.
I've got one final question for you, Adam.
Yes.
So... I don't know how familiar you are with the podcast, but...
I am very familiar with the podcast. I love your podcast, guys. Okay, that's why I'm so thrilled to be on the podcast.
Most episodes, we open what we call the Immaculate Section, and we try and tie Madonna... Well, Andy tries to tie Madonna to whoever we're discussing.
Right.
Other than the fact that Pete Burns was such a huge Madonna stan, is there any... connection between the two, or I guess Danny as well connected them in her two mashups.
Well, no, there is a connection. So who's that girl tour? I believe she had asked Dead or Alive to support, and then I think because Pete was having problems with maybe his surgeries, I don't know the exact story. But it was his mum was unwell. That's right. So his mum was passing away, and they were supposed to be the opening act in Japan, I think, for Madonna, and they couldn't do it. So there's that connection as well.
You've been gutted.
And he, I think they did open for Michael Jackson at one point as well in Japan too.
Wow! 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 This has just been an absolute joy. I've got that like. Kind of lovely warm pain from laughing. So I hope it's been as much of a joy for you two as well and for anyone listening. It's just been absolutely wonderful, Adam, and this will not be your last time on Oral Fixation. We would love to have you back on to talk about Lepa Brenner, your Balkan queen.
I want to do one entire cycle. It's just you as the guest. And we do Eurovision.
Oh my God.
I want to do a special episode only on Big Brother. And the queerness of Big Brother. UK, I hasten to add.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
We want to do all of your Balkan queens.
Yeah, there's
We could definitely do another.
So
the
Balkan queens that. So I'll just say this: like we, the gays on Twitter, cancel these poor Western pop girls for tweets they made when they were 13, 10 years ago. Whereas in the Balkans, they're marrying war criminals, they're getting arrested, they're in house arrest. Like, it's insane. And that's just one of the pop stars. That's not like a collection, that's just one of them. So, it's the Balkan pop world is batshit crazy. And I love it.
Are they on Spotify? That's all we need to know.
They are, yes.
Amazing. I've always just thought there is just something so cool about Adam, you know, you're a Balkan, Australian, queer, Muslim, fabulous gem of a person. And it's always been a delight to know you. And you are going to come back on and we are going to talk about these divas. But thank you so much for everything you brought to this episode and for gifting us new Cleopatra.
Thank you both so much. It's been such an honor, and I'm a big fan of the podcast, so of course I was very excited to come on, and I would love nothing more to come back. So thank you both. Really, really
amazing.
Wonderful, wonderful night talking about Pete and Dieter Olav.
And maybe we'll be on the record, Doctor.
Actually, I would like to talk to you both about doing the Girls Lab podcast that I'm starting.
You are ringing bells with me there, tits.
I'm starting it in December.
There are a few acts that I could talk more about than Girls Aloud. In fact, there's probably...
Sign us up.
There's probably one, and it's Gaga.
Yes.
Yeah, bring it on.
I'll send you both a list.
I would absolutely love to check in.
Yes, I'll send you both a list of, like, the albums and stuff that I'm going to do per episode, because I've worked it all out crazily. And then
you guys can go, I'll do this. You're doing a whole series.
Oh, yeah, it's like a 22 episode or more series on Girls Aloud.
We're there.
Including the solo stuff. We're not looking forward to Messy Little Raindrops.
We're not doing that.
No, you mispronounced it, Adam. It's Messy Little Raindrops. Okay, you can find me under What Will the Neighbours Say? You can find me under under Chemistry. Yeah. You can find me under Tangled Up. And you can find me under Cinderella's Eyes.
Ah, yes. Yes, which is getting its vinyl release for the 10th anniversary.
So, and more to come. Finally. Our Masked Singer UK Season 1 champion.
But Adam, if you get your manager to talk to our managers, let's go through the right channels. We've got to do the right thing.
We want to make sure everything's copacetic. Okay. So, it's all above board here at Oral Fixation. Adam, we've said this already so much, but I am just so pleased that we had this conversation. I think that it's been such a illuminating experience for me to get to know more about Pete Burns and Dead or Alive's discography. It's been such a treat to be able to chat about things I know so well that you know too, and it's also been great to learn more. I am so pleased to, and Andy, you know, I can't speak for you, but I'm sure he will echo this. I'm so pleased to have you on the podcast, and I think that you really crystallize what Oral Fixation is about, which is loving music and shouting about how much you love it from the rooftops, and being vocal about how much it's informed your identity as a queer person and your journey as a queer person. And that is what we're all about. We're all about showcasing those journeys and hopefully allowing others to experience the multitude of queer music journeys that we're all both... that we've all both been on, but are all on, you know, continuing to go on.
Thank you for allowing me to share my story with you both and also your listeners as well. It means a lot, really does.
And let's get a date in the diary once these borders open, which is not long now.
Yes, please. I would love
We'll be down to Vic.
We'll come down to Vic. I'll get some Kylie Rosé.
Yes. And we'll have quite a wonderful night. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
We will.
Be really, really
Bring
good.
It on.
Adam, where can fans and listeners of Oral Fixation, where can they find you? Plug away, baby.
Okay, so obviously monthly, This Is Disco on podcast, which is the Minogue podcast we spoke about before. Every Thursday night is The Record Doctor on Mixcloud, which is my weekly radio show. It's where I do a lot of artist features on Girls Aloud, Madonna, and mixtapes. And social, Adam Eve, A-D-E-M-E-V-E on Twitter, A-D-E-M.E-V-E on Instagram, because some bastard took my handle.
But please follow Adam on Instagram. Even if you don't follow Drew or I or Fixation, follow Adam on Instagram. God.
And as I always say, it's not Adam and Steve. It's Adam.Eve.
Oh, consider that stolen. That is very good.
Andy, where can people find us?
They can find us at With All Drew Respect and or Andrew, Do You Think You Are? They can also find us at Oral Fixation Podcast on Instagram. They can find us on Oral Fix Pod, where Adam and my friendship blossomed. Our handle there is Oral Fix Pod because it's what?
Queer. On Twitter.
We're randomly on Facebook, but those days are probably numbered. Yes, shout out numbered. To Mark Zuck. Oh, yeah. But you can definitely email us oralfixationpodcast@gmail.com, which we love because it's like writing letters to daddy.
You wrote a letter to daddy.
Email the hearts.
Email to my heart.
Yes. I got to be